You just want to introduce yourselves real quick? Just say your name and where you were.
I'm Jamel Bowie. I am a staff writer at the Daily Beast.
I'm Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'm a national correspondent at the Atlantic.
One of the things we always come back to on Code Switch is the idea that the criminal justice system is not really set up to deal with all these larger issues that become tethered to these trials, that are hard not to bring to these trials. And so, you know, you have the Trayvon Martin case became about self-defense laws and gun laws and racial profiling and the criminalization of black men. The problem with that is the criminal justice system, however it resolves one of those cases, doesn't resolve it in a way that is satisfying to all these other issues. But the sentiment I seem to get, both online and from your columns in particular, was just about this idea that it's not even set up to really deal with the particulars in front of it in the given cases, right? So part of the reason that people were so frustrated was that it felt like the resolution of this case didn't even get to the questions that were being asked in this case, right? I mean, there was a mistrial on the charge that everyone thought was the big charge.
One of the more horrifying things is we have this campaign against Stand Your Ground laws right now that's, you know, very active, especially in Florida. And, you know, wishing that all the best. And this goes to, like, all of our issues. This goes to our drug war issues. This goes to everything. If it's not Stand Your Ground, it's going to be something else. Like, this is within the system. This is, like, systemic. It's a virus. And so cutting it out of one area does not mean you have cut it out of the body. And I think that's, like, what is hard for people to get to. White supremacy is at our roots. I don't mean that as a rhetorical statement. Like, it's actually true. Like, black people have been here as long as there's been an America. And for most of the time, black people have been here. The policy of this country is to reduce them to an underclass. That's just the majority of our history. And I understand that, at least in the most explicit terms, over the past 50 years, we've tried to move away from that. But, I mean, you are who you are. Mm-hmm. Or you are what your record says you are.
Right.
And you are what your policy has said you are, you know? And that doesn't go away. And so it always amazes me that we expect to put people in a courtroom and for who we are to go away. You know, it's the most, like, basic thing. Everybody knows that George Washington abdicating and being willing to, you know, not, you know, try to be president for life means something, and that says something about America. And everybody knows that Thomas Jefferson and his genius architecture, writing, everything says something about America. But why does his plunder of Sally Hemings not say something about America, too? Why, you know?
Why does the fact that he had a nail factory that employed exclusively young slave boys?
That's right. Why does that not say something about America, too? Why does not, you know, we want, like, legacy to just be the good things, and it ain't. You know, it can never be that way.
And so we have a case like this that seems to be the latest installment in this long story.
That's right.
And, but you have Trayvon, you know, a couple months beforehand, and then you have Sean Bell and Amadou Diallo. And it seems like every one of these cases is also kind of about those cases too, right?
Right.
So all those things come to bear
on
this case, and they will come to bear on, unfortunately, the next case like this.
I mean, one way to think about this in a broad context, I mean, not to blow this out too much, but Europe has been anti-Semitic for like 2,000 years, right? Like up until the Holocaust, right? Holocaust happens. There have been, you know, many changes in response to that in Europe, right? Would someone look at Europe and say, no, Europe isn't, you know, anti-Semitic, you know, that doesn't have any you know, part in its heritage and what that continent is? No one would look at it that way.
Right.
And yeah, in many ways, they're set up better to deal with it, because if you take, for example, like the understanding that, okay, you live in Germany, so you can't say X, Y, and Z because part of our heritage is this.
Right.
It's an understanding of who they are. And I don't, that's the other problem, like in the American system, where we privilege, you know, individuality, and I love that, right? I love that. I'm not even sure that, you know, I would change that. It becomes very difficult to say, no, we as a collective have certain things.
Right.
Like, it's very difficult to say that.
Even informally. I mean, this, you know, this gets to the really well-worn argument about, can white people say the N-word?
Right.
Right? Like, you know, there's no law that you can't, but ideally, there's a collective understanding that this word means a very particular thing in this country, and that if you're white, you shouldn't say it.
Right.
And even that's contentious,
right?
Like
right.
even something like that is attacked as speech policing and thought policing and just unfair. Whereas, in Germany, wouldn't there would be no controversy about it. You can't even have, you can't own Nazi memorabilia in Germany.
Right. Period. End of conversation.
Yeah.
To your point about kind of the idea of like reasonability, right? Like of the reasonable person is a person who would see, who might see Jordan Davis and his friends as threats, right? I mean, there was a story, and we kind of shared it among our team, about that was in the First Coast Times. I guess it's like a Jacksonville news site that was covering the trial. And the story was basically, the entire story was, this is what was playing in the car when the shooting happened. It was basically like, these are the lyrics. They say the N-word a lot. They curse a lot. It's gangster rap, whatever. And it almost was like, I mean, it didn't come up and say, like, well, wouldn't you be scared too? But that seemed to be the intimation, right? That seemed to be the thing that was being kind of implied very strongly. And I think it's like one of the things, I mean, so in the Trayvon case, there was the hoodie too, right? I mean, these are things that hip hop is basically global, is the dominant musical idiom for people under the age
it's
of.
It's global youth culture.
Everywhere, right? But it can still, at the same time, it has all this kind of, this very particular resonance for people as like this like threatening thing. And Jordan Davis kind of looked the part, I suppose, right? He looked threatening. You know, there were people who were willing, at least in the First Coast Times, which is a news outlet, like were willing to like give credence to this idea, like, well, wouldn't you be scared too?
If it was a car full of white kids, would that have gone down as it did, even if they were listening to the same music?
Right.
Okay. But also beyond that, hip hop is no more violent than American pop culture is violent. What do our video games look like? What do our movies look like? What do our comic books look like? Is hip hop really actually any different than the country, you know, from which it comes? And yet hip hop particularly is thug culture.
Mm-hmm.
Hip hop particularly.
And Dunn said that on the stand. I mean, he said this is thug music. Or he said it's rap crap. And his fiance said it was thug music.
Yes. And that's a particular thing. But in fact, it's actually not very different than the culture within it, the broader culture within which it resides. Which is not to say it shouldn't be critiqued, but I'm saying that those other things are not affixed with that label. And so often this is how racism actually works. It's not, you know, like Barack Obama is an exceptional individual. OK, it is not the exceptional individuals who are the test cases for whether the country is racist or not. You know, it's when we start, you know, getting to the mean, to the thing that, you know, all of us share, or very often in the case of criminal justice, to those who are, you know, even, you know, below the mean, if we want to put it that way. How are they then treated? Like, that really is the question. If you mess up, two people mess up, are they treated equally? That really is the test case. Not can an exceptional person break all barriers? Well, yeah. I mean, in America, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that ain't that, you know, the majority of black people are not going to be exceptional. They're going to be mediocre because the majority of white people are not going to be exceptional. They're going to be mediocre because the majority of human beings are going to be mediocre. The test case is not our exceptions. It's the ordinary. Mm-hmm. And in the sense that hip hop is like the rest of American culture, Why that particular label?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't make sense. I used to, you know, like a lot of kids, my favorite comic book hero when I was a kid was Wolverine, whose body count in a single comic book could be ridiculous. I mean, was I, you know, engaging in, you know, thug, in murderous art? Was that without, well, yeah, kinda, wasn't I? But why hip-hop? Nobody was afraid that I was going to go out and kill a bunch of people. That wasn't.
No one would go to like a comic shop and see a bunch of kids trading Wolverine and Deadpool comics say those are a bunch of potential
murderers.
That's
right. That's right.
We would all treat them as distinct individuals, as well you should.
Right.
And that's just a testament to racism, right? That's, you know, no Dunn, Zimmerman, each of these people did not look at Trayvon or Jordan as distinct individuals. They were thugs. Nondescript mass of you know, black threat, which is, you know, I wouldn't say in their defense, but sort of like in the broad context, that's just how we've portrayed black men for 100 years.
What Jamel is saying is actually very important because the loss of individuality, the obliteration of you as a distinct person is what racism does. Is what racism has always done, is the point of racism, to mark somebody by their skin and say everybody who looks like this is subject to X. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, you know, whether you're better at this, whether, you know, she's worse at this, whether she's better. It doesn't matter. You are all this. It is an obliteration of everything about you as an individual. Like, who Jordan Davis is, who his mother was. For instance, the fact that he was homeschooled for many years. The fact that he was in ROTC and thinking about going into the military. This has no meaning. It really, you know, it doesn't matter whether his father was a good father. Nobody cares. As a human being, what marks you is that you have individuality. Racism strips that away. When you say, because you are X color in Virginia in 1650, whatever, and you strike somebody who is, you know, Y color, you will be punished in this particular way that's different. When you say, because you are X color, you are not allowed to have the franchise, you're not allowed to vote. When you say, if you are X color, you are not allowed to own arms. See, even after those laws are repealed, like, that becomes part of who we are. Messages are sent. Messages, and it becomes a legacy. So that by the time you get to a Jordan Davis, man, you're way late. Like, you're so late. I mean, you're in the fourth quarter, right? But the team was being built somewhere way, way back before preseason. And here you are in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl saying, okay, how are we going to win this? But, like, the game started a long time ago. You know, the building, the construction of the team started a long time ago in the construction of America and who we are. To expect us to be able to resolve this in a courtroom is, on the one hand, understandable, but on the other hand, utterly absurd.
So I'm curious as to whether you think, if the case were resolved a different way, had he been found guilty on the murder charge, would that have changed? Like, what, if anything, that would have changed?
Look, I put on weight easily, right? At one point in my life, I lost 50 pounds. That did not change the fact that I put on weight easily. That didn't change who I was through extraordinary effort. And in fact, through consciousness of the fact that I put on weight easily, I was able to do that. But see, we don't want to be like conscious. That's what we're saying. We want to be unconscious and then pretend like it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Again, the idea that black men, black boys, the idea that they're inherently criminal is old. It's at least as old as what we think of as the modern United States. And, you know, if you're going to be really comprehensive, it's as old as the United States itself. And so it's no surprise that those behaviors that are pretty ordinary for the teenage boys become something sinister and pathological when it comes to black boys. If you look at, you know, 19th century urban newspapers in a place like New York or Philadelphia, these are cities that are rife with crime. And they're rife with crime from all of the immigrant groups. That includes Southern black migrants. That includes Italian Americans, Irish Americans, Eastern Europeans. But it's only in those newspapers that you have sensationalized headlines about the black crime, even though it's indistinguishable from the crime of their, you know, white ethnic European peers. And sort of more importantly for, you know, public policy, at least, associations in the city governments take steps to try to find ways to reduce the crime among the white European kids, and then say to themselves, well, the blacks, that's just how they are. You know, that's just, we'll leave them be. We'll try to cordon off their neighborhoods as best as possible. So for this next generation of people, they see all the blacks cordon off in their area, and they see the crime there, and they say, well, obviously, it must be something wrong with them.
That's so sad.
So we see these sorts of dynamics for all sorts of groups, and, you know, blacks have been the subject of it for our entire time in this country. Mm. And I have no conclusion other than to say it's really frustrating to see, you know, what kind of music was he listening to? He was listening to that hip-hop thug music. Well, you know, if hip-hop music is thug music, then part of that is a function of the fact that, like, a lot of these people came out of neighborhoods that were created by public policy.
That's right. That's right. And so this gets, like, to the whole thing about, yeah, but y'all don't talk about black-on-black crime, right? But,
Because that is always the detail, right? I mean, that's always...
Well, first of all, it has no meaning because nobody talks more about black-on-black crime than black people.
Yeah, right.
No one. I mean, it's not our fault that, you know, people who say that don't pay attention. It's just not a respectable claim at all. I mean, the idea that when Hadiya Pendleton got killed, that black people in Chicago weren't talking about that is ridiculous.
It was all over the news, and Michelle Obama talked about it.
Exactly. Yeah. It was everywhere. Mm-hmm. It was everywhere. And
I mean, it's part of casual conversation. I can't even count the number of times I've heard my parents or in church.
It's like, constant.
We got to stop killing ourselves.
Oh, like, my that's, God. It's constant. Just, the song was called Self-Destruction. that was the actual song. That was the name of it.
Right.
That's like a real thing. And that... In fact, more than any sort of thought about Klan violence or anything like that, you know, in my youth, that was the constant drumbeat in Baltimore. And so the idea that black folks don't talk, first of all, is false. But let's just pull out for a second and go like, you know, 1,000 feet in the air and look at that. The neighborhoods in which there are higher crime rates for African-Americans, in which larger numbers of African-Americans are killed by other African-Americans, were produced by policy. Like, they, you know, like, the South Side of Chicago is not a mistake. North Lawndale is not a mistake. West Baltimore is not a mistake. It was supposed to happen that way. And so, you know, it is watching a state, a society, perpetrate an injury upon a group of people and then hide it and then use the results, as Jamel just said, as justification to then perpetrate more injury over and over and over and over again. You know, King Lear has this great line at the beginning where King Lear said, you know, in Shakespeare, he, you know, basically destroys everybody's lives because he doesn't want to take the hard, you know, choice of, you know, saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. And I always think about that. While we unburden, crawl towards death. And it's like, that's what we want to do, you know, to shake all cares and worries from our age. And that's what we want to do. And we pass it on to the next generation, you know? And so, like, if we don't face up to this, the horrifying thing is that there will be more policy, right? You can, you know, get rid of Stand Your Ground, but if you don't have that deeper conversation, you will pass this on to another generation who will then pass other policy that will do this again.
Do you think these cases make good jumping off points to talk about those other things? I mean, they become flashpoints for those other things, but do they result in conversations about these?
No. In part, because they're almost too particular. Right. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I got a couple emails from folks who said, I don't know why you had to bring race into this case.
Can we talk about respectability a bit? Because that's always part of this conversation. When Trayvon, there was a whole lot of conversation around whether you should have been wearing a hoodie or not.
The respectability politics is both a response of and utterly incompatible with the existence of racism.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like Ta-Nehisi noted. Racism, by definition, racism obliterates the individual.
Right.
So if you are if any three of us as, you know, fine upstanding citizens.
So you think.
were to find ourselves in Jordan Davis's place, wouldn't matter. Right? Wouldn't matter.
Mm-hmm. I have a piece I'm working on, and I guess I can share this. And a buddy of mine who was killed.
I was going to ask. I didn't know if that was in bounds.
Yeah, no, you can. And we went to school together, and he was killed. His mother was a radiologist. She made the mistake of being an American and buying her son a Jeep for his 23rd birthday. He went out in that Jeep. The police were out in Prince George's County. We're looking for a suspect with a Jeep of the similar make. They ran the tags. The tags came up to this, you know, for this woman in Pennsylvania who was his mother because that's where it was registered. They assumed it was stolen. Followed this young man through three jurisdictions and shot him. My friend Prince Jones was a born-again Christian. He was going to see his daughter and his fiancée. His mother was perfectly upstanding. She comes from... Her dad was a sharecropper in Louisiana. This woman became a radiologist. I mean, she's, you know, the cream. Her life was plundered. Her legacy was plundered. Her child was taken away. Respectability has nothing to do with this. The way to do it is not to make black people more respectable. It is to make the country more respectable of itself. Listen, that brother's mother, I sat with her, and she said, I had talked to him about how to deal with the police. It's not like we didn't have that conversation. Yeah, we did. I talked to Lucia McBath, Jordan Davis's mother. I talked to Jordan about that. It's not like we didn't have a conversation about how to, you know, comport himself when he's out. But that boy is 17 years old. You can't, like, say the way to not get killed is to have the maturity of a 45-year-old. I mean, that's just, you know, okay, so then we lose. Like, that is actual racist logic because you are not requiring that of white young men. You are not requiring that of white 17-year-olds. You're only requiring that of black people. That is racism. And this is like, I'm going to get in trouble here, but this is like, this will always be my beef with telling your children that they must do twice as good. You have conceded to racism. And it's understandable why somebody would feel that way, right? Like, yeah. Individuals always look for their agency. It's not, you know, there's nothing, you know, particularly wrong with that. But as writers, you know, as skeptics of society, you then have to say, okay, so is that actually going to help? Look, I have a 13-year-old.
I was about to ask you about that, too.
I got a son.
How do you talk to him about this? I mean, how do you, like, about something like this?
I hold him to the standard of himself. I hold him to the standard of himself. You know, like all 13-year-olds, he talks about what he's going to do one day. I'm going to go do this for Google, and I'm going to do that. And okay, but are you like, taking that seriously?
So, when did you watch this case or the Trayvon case with your son at all, Zamar?
I can't. No, absolutely not.
Do you talk about these things, like, even broadly? Or this is like, how do you talk about, I mean, how does it come up?
Well, it's the air in our house, right? Because, I mean, that's, you know, just like what I write about. That's what we've talked about since he. But even after everything I said about being skeptical and everything, you know, my relationship is to him as my son and a human being. You know, so at the end of the day, I am deeply concerned, you know. And we talk about politics, but I feel like he's got that. Like, we got that. Again, because it's the air of the house, you know, it's so much everywhere. And all my friends talk about when, you know, my friends come over for dinner, it's the conversation that's there, you know. Frankly, my and I guess in this sense, I don't differ too much from any white parent. You know, my great interest is that he take himself seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, and if he does that, all of this other, you know, jazz about being twice as good and having a fallback, all that, which just is such like loser.
I completely agree with you. I mean, I can't. It's a thing that I think. I don't know. I mean, did you get that growing up too? I mean, did you get that? I got that all the time from.
No, I didn't actually. You know what? My parents never said that to me. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that is why it sounds strange to me. I mean, I didn't. I wanted to be a rapper. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a rapper. And we took it. Yeah, I did. And it was a huge part of my life. And I wrote a lot. And, you know, we had one of those little, you know, basement studios at a friend of mine's house that, if you can imagine, where we used to record.
And
you know what my parents said? Jesus, there are so many horrible things happening in this city. And whatever you were doing down there, it ain't part of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm really, really happy that you're taking something seriously. Like, mm-hmm. I'm really, really, really happy about that. No one ever did that. No one. I mean, people try very hard to broaden my horizons, to understand that I, you know, if I was saying I wanted to do X, Y, and Z, it wasn't simply because only X, Y, and Z was on the table. Mm-hmm. That was big. Okay, that's fine. You like that, but let's go see this. Let's go, you know, okay, but there's this over here too. And have you thought about this? But no one ever said, I don't know. Like, black kids who want to be LeBron James are not original. White kids want to be LeBron James, too. Yeah. They just have access to more choices beyond LeBron James.
Absolutely.
Speaking of someone who grew up around a lot of white kids, when I was in sixth grade, really wanted to be Hulk Hogan.
Right. Right. And no one said, be realistic.
Absolutely. Right.
You know, they said, oh, you're being a child. That's what they said.
So neither of you got the talk? Like, I mean.
Did you get that?
I got elements of it. And I you know, I went to church growing up. And so there was a lot of that. In my church, which makes total sense, you know, a bunch of old black Southerners. Mm-hmm. And an old black Southern church, there's lots of, you know, you got to be twice as good.
Right.
You have to be better than everyone else, that sort of thing. So that was, you know, that was part of my upbringing. But it was around so much that I just don't even, it doesn't even, like, you know, I'm not very reflective about it.
It's just
kind of
like
the air. And I guess I would have thought, I should correct that. It was the air. Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm thinking about it now, like, my parents didn't talk like that, but it was the air in which the community, I mean, my, you know, middle school, which was one of the most violent middle schools in Baltimore City, they had us arranged into teams. Each of the teams were named after a prominent African-American. I was on the Marshall team. Everywhere there was these signs, achieve, success. You know, people think this is new. I mean, but that's like in fact, that's how you know you're in the hood.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Outside here, they don't say that. They just assume that that's true, right?
Absolutely right.
You know,
absolutely,
you are in a success zone. You know, I am arming people to achieve. I mean, that's the logic of the hood. I mean, that's how you know you are now in the hood.
That's absolutely right.
Because when you ain't, they name it after something else because they don't even have to say it, you know? It's like having new money, you know, and you're flashy with new money. It's the very same way. People who are wealthy don't got to do that. They don't got to talk about that. You know, achievement is their legacy. It's what they do. It is those of us who have been down that have to say things like twice as good, do this, do that, do that. You know, and look, we're not wrong. Mm. We're not wrong. I want to be very, very clear about that. I am not, you know, attacking black people for being humans. but that ain't going to get us out of here. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Mm. It's like, I mean, the way to understand this is, first of all, respectability politics are not new, right?
Mm. Right.
W.E.B. Du Bois, turn of the century. W.E.B. Du Bois, who later became one of the biggest critics of
respectability
politics in Booker T. Washington, mm-hmm. makes a speech for his Association of Black Sociologists and says, listen, the biggest problem in our community is basically promiscuity, loafing, and, you know, basically internal sin. I mean, he just goes off and says, these are our biggest problems. Now, what historian would look at the turn of the century when black people were being lynched all through the South, when huge numbers of black people were effectively in a kind of modern slavery in debt peonage and sharecropping, and say, these people clearly weren't moral enough? Mm-hmm. Is that the analysis that anybody would draw from that?
Right.
No one would say that.
Being moral enough doesn't keep Tulsa from getting burned down.
Right. You know, my parents are still scared to this day. Mm-hmm. You know, and that don't go away.
Yeah, I remember having very distinct rules. I have a twin sister. She had rules around, like, you know, if you go out, don't leave a drink unattended. Blah, 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 blah. But I got rules around how to behave around the cops. And, like, I got that conversation, right?
Right.
The thing that I think that is scary is that, you know, it sound, you know, when you're 14, 15, your parents know are the smartest people in the world to you, right? And you got into the world, you realize, like, none of that would have helped. If Jordan Davis would have been in the car and turned down or whatever it was, or if he would have said, yes, sir,
or
no,
someone
man,
said to me, had he been listening to jazz music?
Right, exactly. Yeah. that it would have changed the outcome. And that's horrible. I mean, it's horrible that I can't be a person, that Jordan Davis couldn't be a person.
That's
he couldn't
right.
be a teenage kid.
That's
you
right.
know?